Hi, it's great to have your company. You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. My name's Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
Religion influences American politics more than any other Western developed nation. Almost all of the US presidents have been openly religious, and close to half of them have belonged to the nation's major Protestant denominations.
Let me first of all say, to God be the glory.
I'm a Protestant. I'm very proud of it. Presbyterian, to be exact.
Nothing's more important to me than my family, my faith, and my friends.
I am blessed to receive a word from God every day and receiving the scriptures and reading the scriptures, and God speaks through the Bible.
And imagine what we can build together when each and every American has the chance to live up to his or her own God-given potential. Thank you all so very much.
The expression of faith is also a prominent feature in US politics more broadly. So presidents and other politicians often invoke religion in major speeches. They'll ask God to bless America, they'll promote Christian values, and especially in times of tragedy or after a natural disaster, they send prayers to victims and affected communities.
There's been another mass shooting in America. May God bless the memories of those who were killed today. May he bring comfort to their families and courage to the injured as they fight their way back. And may he give us the strength to come together and find the courage to change.
Joining us today to shed some light on this very complex and deep relationship between religion and politics in the US is Dr. David Smith, who's the senior lecturer in American politics and foreign policy at the United States Study Center at the University of Sydney. David, great to have you in.
Thanks for having me.
David, let's start with the current situation in the US. The nation is partway through the presidential primaries, and you've described this as a religiously unusual election. Now, can you unpack that statement a little bit for us?
Yes, it's religiously unusual because at the moment, the Republican frontrunner is one of the least religious candidates in the field. He's quite unusual in that his whole manner, his demeanor, and the things that he talks about, these are not typically the things that Christian Republican voters are looking for, especially evangelical Protestants. But yet he is picking up large numbers of evangelical voters. It's also unusual because on the Democratic side, one of the contenders is a secular Jewish man. And this is the first time that anybody who doesn't profess Christian faith has got this far in a presidential race. So it is a religiously unusual year.
Right. So Donald Trump is not only unusual in other ways, but particularly in this regard, in terms of religion and politics.
Yeah. He's only really got the barest familiarity with Christianity. He does claim to be a Christian. He says he's a strong Christian, but he doesn't really make much of a pretense of being a very strong Christian. He has done the usual things that Republican candidates have to do, doing things like going to Liberty University. He even got the endorsement of Jerry Falwell Jr., the son of one of the most powerful figures in evangelical politics. But when he actually talks about Christianity, he does so in very vague terms. He said that the Bible is his favorite book. I don't know if anyone really believes him when he says that. So he tries to go through some of the motions of Christianity, but unlike many other presidential candidates of recent years, he doesn't actually talk Christian language.
So is it significant that Trump is supposed to be this person who doesn't care about political correctness, and yet in this respect, even he will make some pretense, some gesture towards the Christian crowd?
Oh, yes, because quite simply, you have to.
Can you unpack that a little bit for people who aren't as familiar with US politics as some?
Well, if you're running for public office in the United States, you need to have a religious identification of some kind. It's always better to be something than nothing. There has only been one person in the history of the United States Congress who has openly identified as an atheist. That was Representative Pete Stark from California. In contrast, there have been two representatives who have actually identified with the Church of Scientology. So that's how rare it is for someone not to actually profess any religious faith. Christianity is the dominant religion in the United States, and most people running for public office profess some form of Christianity. There are Muslim members of Congress like Keith Ellison from Minnesota. There have been Jewish members of Congress for a very long time as well. Joe Lieberman from Connecticut, who was a senator, was a vice presidential candidate back in 2000. But Christianity is certainly the dominant religion within American politics. And some people make much more of a display of it than others and are far more emphatic about their Christian beliefs. So in the current field, for example, Ted Cruz, whose father is an evangelical pastor, he really, and especially given the language that he chooses, such as when he was urging his opponents to drop out of the presidential race and ask them to prayerfully consider leaving. So the language that he chooses, that's very typical of a candidate who is putting Christianity at the center of their candidacy. George W. Bush was another very good example of this. The language that he used was infused with biblical references, which often went over the heads of people who weren't well-versed in Christianity, but were certainly well understood by his intended audience. A kind of contrast would be someone like Barack Obama, who professes a strong Christian faith, but doesn't make a huge deal out of it in office, except for, as was mentioned earlier, when there's national tragedies. So after every mass shooting, and Barack Obama has had to give addresses after a really sad number of those, he does go into his faith, and he does use the classic sort of prayer-like invocations of things like God bless America. So regardless of whether candidates put it at the center of their candidacy, like Cruz or Bush, or whether they profess it but don't make it the center of their candidacy, like Barack Obama or like John F. Kennedy, for example, just about everybody does profess certainly religious beliefs of some kind, and usually Christianity.
Really, the strange thing about this is that we talk about the principle of separation of church and state, and that's an American principle, and yet religion is so prominent in their politics. How do those two things fit together?
Well, separation of church and state in the US has never meant separation of religion from politics. In fact, you could say that the wall of separation between church and state has perhaps led to an unusually strong infusion of religion with politics. And the reason for that is that the constitutional separation of church and state, which originally all that really meant was that the federal government wouldn't materially support any churches. What that meant was that churches became very entrepreneurial in the United States because they needed to essentially compete with each other for members. And this led to many sort of waves of religious vibrancy as churches explored new dimensions of Christianity, new manifestations of spirituality, new ways of worshipping, to the point where you have this very diverse religious marketplace where just about anybody with any kind of religious belief can find what they want. And this has always played a very strong role in politics. If you go all the way back to someone like Abraham Lincoln, who really couched the struggle for emancipation in very Christian terms, if you look at the civil rights struggle of Martin Luther King, once again, Christianity played a central role in that, but so did other religions. So did Judaism. A lot of the civil rights workers who came from the North to the South to help with the Freedom Rides were young Jewish students who were equally motivated by their own religious beliefs. So Americans have never shied away from religion playing a role in politics. In fact, if you look at the way that the country was founded, there's been this sense of religious mission there from the beginning, even before the first ships of the Pilgrims got to the United States and John Winthrop stood on the deck of the Arabella on its way to Massachusetts and said that this colony they were going to found would be a city on a hill. It would be an example to the world of what God intended. I think Australia is a more typical example of a country like Britain as well, or like a lot of European countries, where there isn't the same kind of separation of church and state. The government does materially support churches. There's a bit more sort of regulation of religious life. but there's a sense of decorum around religion that, because of the fact that religion can be a source of social conflict, and certainly if you look at Australia's Catholic Protestant history, you can see where this is coming from, that it's best to, if not completely minimize the role of religion in public life, to try not to have it as a source of antagonism and disagreement. Whereas in the United States, people are quite happy to make religious disagreement part of political disagreement.
So to bring things back to this year's election, we're going to take a closer look at the Republicans first. So here's a quick grab from a political ad by Marco Rubio.
Our goal is eternity, the ability to live alongside our Creator for all time, to accept the free gift of salvation offered to us by Jesus Christ. The purpose of our life is to cooperate with God's plan. I'm Marco Rubio, and I approved this message.
According to research from the Pew Center, around two-thirds of Republicans say that it's important for a president to share their religious beliefs. It's a bit less for the Democrats, but still, you know, a little under half. Can you explain for us, David, the historical connection between the religious right and the Republican Party? That wasn't always the same thing.
It was not always the case. And in fact, the components of what we now call the religious right, so conservative white evangelical Protestants and conservative Catholics, they both used to be part of the Democratic Party's coalition. The major concentration of white evangelicals was in southern states, which were dominated by the Democratic Party until the 1960s. And Catholics had also been part of the Democratic coalition from the early 19th century, because the Democrats were the party that believed that religious minorities who came as immigrants should be allowed to preserve their own customs and their own way of life, whereas the Whigs and the Republicans, who are the successor party to the Whigs, believed that immigrant religious minorities needed to be Americanized. Now, there was quite a sharp divide in American society between Catholic and Protestant until World War II, when the effect of Catholics and Protestants, as well as Jews, all fighting alongside each other really helped break down those social barriers. And certainly during the Cold War, successive administrations promoted ecumenicism and religiosity as an antidote to communism. So around the 1950s and 60s, as these social barriers began to break down, John F. Kennedy became the president, the first Catholic to do so, and with a record number of Catholic votes and with a record small number of Protestant votes. No president has ever won the presidency with that few Protestant votes before or since. But John F. Kennedy really believed in the minimization of religion in public life in a way that no president before or since really has. And that was partly to try to alleviate concerns about his own Catholicism. Now, this, coupled with the Democrats taking on the mantle of being the party of civil rights, really began to kind of unmoor the South from the Democratic Party. And especially the candidacy of Barry Goldwater in 1964, who opposed the Civil Rights Act, this began a very sort of long and slow progression of the South into the Republican Party and taking with it that real conservative evangelical bloc. Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan both recognized that this shift was underway and started to build their electoral strategies around the South. And Ronald Reagan in particular recognized the importance of this emerging religious bloc. Evangelicals had largely stayed out of politics since the 1920s, when the Scopes trial in Tennessee had been this sort of nationally humiliating experience. But the 70s was when they really began to reemerge, energized and mobilized by the Republican Party. Ronald Reagan also recognized that conservative Catholics who had been part of the Democratic coalition could also be brought into the Republican coalition, and the issue that would bring them in was abortion. In 1973, nearly all of the opposition to Roe versus Wade was led by Catholics, and in fact, it was seen as such a Catholic cause that actually the Southern Baptist Convention wanted nothing to do with it. But by the late 1970s, the Republican Party had really managed to bring these two groups together around the basis of kind of shared values, and especially over the issue of abortion. And over the next 20 years, abortion would become a real litmus test within the Republican Party. Essentially, you couldn't get nominated as a Republican without taking a very strong anti-abortion stance. And a similar thing happened on the other side, which was that being pro-choice became a litmus test in the Democratic Party. You can't really get nominated now in the Democratic Party without having a fairly strong pro-choice viewpoint. And because of the visibility and the clear separation on this issue, essentially what we've seen is a religious realignment. And Robert Putnam and David Campbell talk about this in their wonderful book, American Grace, where they say religious conservatives and traditionalists and orthodox people of all kinds, Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, even Muslim before 9/11, are now basically on the Republican side, whereas more religiously liberal and secular people are on the Democratic side. And that divide is really only getting more visible. And so that is why, the religious right as we understand it today is on the Republican side of politics. But that certainly hasn't always been the case.
Putnam and others, people like Marsha Paulian, have mentioned that this has been a bit of a disaster, this description you've just given, for both the GOP and also for the evangelical Christian church. And that they talk about a breed of new evangelicals who are, especially the younger ones, who are interested in more than just a sort of narrow band of issues and more interested in things like environmental issues, questions of justice and compassion. They talked about this in the last two elections playing a role. Do you think it did, and do you think it will in this next election?
Yeah, there is a major tension visible in the politics of younger evangelicals because, yes, they're a lot more concerned with things like the environment. So whereas most of the Republican Party, religious or secular, rejects the idea that global warming is taking place, younger evangelicals are very concerned about that and actually very concerned that by neglecting this issue, we are seriously neglecting our responsibilities as God's people. Younger evangelicals are also far more likely to be welcoming of immigrants and of refugees. And they also take a very strong stance on issues that are otherwise out of the political mainstream, like human trafficking. So especially as a point of emphasis, younger evangelicals don't want to be all about abortion and opposing gay marriage. So yes, I think a lot of younger evangelicals do feel very straitjacketed by the kind of mold of evangelical politics that was forged by people like Jerry Falwell and by Pat Robertson. But going back to what you originally said about the potential for disaster, yes, it is a potential for disaster for evangelicals because once any group gets completely captured by one party, they can be ignored by both parties. And as much as evangelicals liked George W. Bush, for example, at the end of his presidency, a lot of them were really asking, what did he actually do for us? How did he actually advance our aims? And, you know, the answer is not very far. It also could be very dangerous for the Republican Party to become so identified with a particular form of Christianity, because the Republican Party has a wide range of ideological beliefs that are not all related to religious conservatism. And there would be people who are, in general, sympathetic to their view of having very small government, low taxes, a strong military, but without wanting the religious baggage that goes along with that. So it is potentially dangerous for Republicans. Of course, there are dangers for the Democratic Party as well in becoming increasingly secular, because in a country that is, you know, between 60 and 70% Christian, you've got very narrow margins electorally to work with if you can't get at least some of those people into your tent.
If you've just joined us, we're talking with Dr. David Smith, an expert in US politics and religion from the United States Studies Center.
Well, turning to the Democrats on the other side, so this is from Bernie's interview on Jimmy Kimmel Live.
Do you believe in God, and do you think that's important to the people of the United States?
Well, I am who I am, and what I believe in and what my spirituality is about is that we're all in this together. That I think it is not a good thing to believe that as human beings, we can turn our backs on the suffering of other people.
When Bernie Sanders won the New Hampshire primary, he was the first non-Christian to do so, and that was a huge deal. David, do you think that that does have significant implications kind of ongoing for how influential religion is in US politics?
I think it does, especially on the Democratic Party side, in terms of someone in the Democratic Party doesn't need to profess Christianity, doesn't really need to profess religion that much at all, and can still do pretty well, even if not get the nomination. Bernie Sanders is very interesting. Despite being very secular, he is very plugged in to Jewish religious intellectual tradition. And, I mean, he really is a creature of that New York Jewish intellectual world, which even in its secular form is still very tied to the religious tradition in Judaism, which is a very, very cerebral one and a very intellectual one and involves very kind of rigorous examination of political questions. So he's still in close consultation with various rabbis. And even though he is not very religious to himself, he certainly isn't hostile to religion, whether it be Jewish or Christian.
David, when you mentioned the fact that to get anywhere in public office in America, traditionally you've had to have a pretty prominent faith, that must make it a bit hard to work out who's genuine about their faith. Do people become cynical about that because because of the fact that you've got to be able to make these pronouncements that are just part of the territory?
I think people can get pretty cynical about it, and I think that Donald Trump has really raised it to new levels of cynicism. When he claimed he was audited by the IRS because he was a strong Christian, I mean, nobody is
The Pope wasn't convinced.
Buying that bizarre claim. Yes, there was his flame war with the Pope. So I think that it is widely understood, or at least widely suspected, that a lot of politicians are not particularly religious. But just the fact that they do profess faith is considered important in itself. And just interestingly on that point, there was a bit of controversy when it became known that Barack Obama didn't actually have a church in Washington, D.C. that he attends, until it was also pointed out that George W. Bush, whose Christianity is not in doubt at all, also never attended church in Washington, D.C., nor did Ronald Reagan. It turns out the presidents have quite a lot to do. Dwight Eisenhower thought that it was so important to have a public profession of faith that despite not being particularly religious up until the point that he became president, he was actually publicly baptized just before his inauguration. I mean, once in office, he wasn't attending church particularly regularly. It's hard to say how religious he was, but he just believed that profession of religious faith was very important.
Last year, you published a book about religious minorities and persecution. How does that issue feature so far in the US election cycle?
It features less this time around than it did the last time around. The last time around, it was remarkable to have a Mormon candidate. And there were a lot of questions asked about would conservative Christian Republicans actually be able to support somebody like this? Now, it turned out that most of them did in the end. And part of the reason for that was that he was running against Barack Obama, whom something like 40% of Republicans believe is a Muslim. And another 20% are convinced that he's an atheist. One thing that we're seeing this time around, though, is the language of religious liberty is very important on the Republican side, although under a very narrow usage of the term. Religious liberty has become the battle cry of people who want to resist the fact that the Supreme Court has now said that same-sex marriage is legal in every state. It's become the battle cry of those who want to resist the provisions in the Affordable Care Act that say that when companies provide insurance to their employees, that insurance has to cover birth control and contraception. However, they're not talking about things like Donald Trump's plan to ban Muslims from entering the United States. They're not talking about the discourse that is widespread within the Republican Party about wanting to shut down mosques or put them under police surveillance. So it's really a very kind of narrow understanding of religious liberty that is being talked about, but is nonetheless being talked about a lot.
David, I want to ask you about the way in which America is also like the rest of the Western world at least, becoming more secular than it was at least. So, yes, and especially among young people. So they identified those who are the no religion box to tick on the survey.
Yeah.
Do you imagine that that will, if it continues in that direction, have an effect on American politics eventually?
It probably will. And I mean, a couple of things about this trend. It doesn't necessarily mean atheists or people without any religion at all. It's people who don't identify with any particular organized religion. So you could say it's churches and denominations who really have the problem there. The number of people who actually identify as atheists or agnostics, it remains stable at around 5%, and that's what it's been for years. The other thing about the United States is that there have been periods before where religious adherence has really dropped. Around the time of the American Revolution, for example, it's estimated that it had dropped to around 20%. But then there are always these big revivals that take place. There was the First Great Awakening in the 18th century, the Second Great Awakening in the 19th century. So there could be well be another Great Awakening just around the corner. But there is this increasing trend towards secularization, which it's not just reflected in the way that people identify or don't identify as religious. It's also really reflected in popular culture as well. In terms of politics, I think that there is actually an increasing acceptance that Christian morality will no longer be the basis of things like marriage. And when you look at the issues that voters rank as most important, what's striking, for example, about gay marriage, whether you support it or oppose it, it's a long way down the list. And it's actually especially a long way down the list for people who oppose it. It appears that even though many evangelicals are opposed to same-sex marriage, they are on the point of actually giving that up, of recognizing that it's lost, that on this issue at least, Christianity is not going to be the basis of law.
Well, David, thank you so much for unpacking some of these complexities for us, bringing your formidable expertise to bear on it. We can't let you go, though, without asking for your predictions for the 2016 election. What's going to happen?
Well, it looks like Hillary Clinton is going to be the Democratic Party nominee. I think that Bernie Sanders will contest it all the way to the convention, which will ensure that Hillary Clinton continues to take fairly liberal positions on most issues. On the Republican side, it's a bit trickier. Donald Trump looks to be quite hard to stop at the moment, albeit he did have some losses in the so-called Super Saturday primaries early in March. Even if nobody overtakes Donald Trump in the delegate count, if he doesn't get a majority of delegates, it's possible that at the convention, other candidates could actually band together to deny him the nomination and give it to somebody else. If that happens, then he would almost certainly run as a third party candidate and Hillary Clinton would almost certainly win the election. If, however, Trump does get the nomination, is allowed to get it, although all of the matchup polling between him and Hillary Clinton suggests that Hillary Clinton would win quite easily, if there's a recession between now and the election, the president's party traditionally gets battered at an election. And it wouldn't even be so much about Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. It would be more of a kind of referendum on the Obama presidency and on the Democratic Party. So it is possible that we could be one recession away from a Donald Trump presidency, which is not a very comforting thought to most people. But still, at the moment, the likelihood is that Hillary Clinton will be the next president.
Well, thank you for leaving us with that thought, Dave. And so good to get your wisdom on all of this. All this kind of complex stuff. And from this distance, we're kind of bemused by it and perplexed. So thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Life and Faith. If you enjoyed this episode, why not hop onto iTunes and leave a rating or a review for us? Just type Center for Public Christianity in the search box to find us. We'd really appreciate your feedback. Next week, we'll be celebrating Easter and looking at what it means to love your neighbour.